Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Illustration Department Podcast. My name is Giuseppe Castellano. In this podcast, I talk to folks in illustration, graphic design, publishing, animation, and other creative fields about their beginnings, their successes, and the bumps and bruises they've experienced along the way. In this episode, my guest is Caldecott Medal-winning illustrator Mary Azarian. There's no such thing as the right age to start a creative career. You start when you start. In Mary's case, she was 30. At 59, she won the Caldecott for Snowflake Bentley. Among other topics, Mary talks about her career and how much of it came from randomness, circumstance, and luck. We talk about farming and gardening as a way of life and as a subject she explored in her books. And Mary shares advice for any creative person to follow, regardless of their age. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You were born on December 8th, 1940.
Yep.
A day after your one-year birthday was Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you're one, you're two, you're three during the World War II, but do you remember anything about that time?
I don't remember much about the war, and I only remember what I was told about that day, which for as far as my family was concerned, my mother at any rate, I reached up to the table and spilled a cup of scalding tea all over my face, and my skin peeled off. That's what my mother remembers about Pearl Harbor Day. After that, I don't remember anything about the, well, I got over it, whatever happened. I mean, this is just a family story that I've heard. But otherwise, no, I don't remember anything about that era.
Where were you born?
Washington, D.C.
I read that you grew up on your grandfather's farm, and you had a pony by the name of Patsy.
Patsy, indeed I did, yeah.
Was Patsy your responsibility, or sort of quasi your responsibility?
Well, quasi. If anything went wrong in terms of her health, then somebody else took over. But I fed her and rode her every day, and I kind of basically took care of her, cleaned out her stalls, that sort of thing.
What kind of farm was it?
Well, at the time, my parents, we had lived right outside Washington, and my mother and father moved out 10 miles further out when I was around five, I would say. And at that point, my uncle, who had retired, had a vegetable farm, small, you know, stand in the front yard. People came to the stand, and it was an honor donation for the vegetables, and that's how he occupied his time. He raised about 5 acres of tomatoes and other various, mostly southern vegetables to fill the demand for people who had moved to Washington from further south. And my grandfather, who was probably in his 80s at that time, loved poultry, and he raised chickens for eggs mostly, quite a few, a big flock, I'd say maybe 500 chickens.
Oh, geez.
And he also had in their mudroom, he had a place where he weighed the eggs and sorted them, and people came, and same thing, honor system, leave the money, take the eggs.
I'm not a farmer, but my dad is. Or was, and I've half of my family still lives in southern Italy, and
great! How fortunate for you!
Oh yeah. I know how that sounds. It's like it's very lovely, and but it's not like, I mean, it's a hard life. I mean, everyone on that side of the Atlantic are farmers still to this day, mostly dairy, olive groves. You know, vineyards, things like that, you know, Southern Italian stuff.
Yep.
And when we go there, we stay with my aunt, who lives on a farm, and she's got chickens, goats, things like that. When I was a kid, I remember, you know, we go over there and my grandfather, it's the same house, and my aunt now lives there. My grandfather and my grandmother, he still live there. But, you know, we'd go there and his job was walking goats. That was his thing. And they would do the same thing. They have a ton of chickens and, you know, sell eggs. People would walk from town to their farm, which was not just, you know, 10-minute walk outside of town, and buy the eggs and get whatever else they were, you know, offering. And I heard stories where my grandfather would go on walks for days with the goats. My dad, when he was a kid, before he went to school, he would have a bunch of bottles of milk on his bike and ride into town, sell the milk, go to school.
Yeah, when we moved to Vermont, that's kind of what it was like here too. Not now, but it certainly was then.
I understand that your first etching experience came in fourth grade.
Well, not etching. It was linoleum cut, like wood cut. Wood cut is where I finally have landed. I did etching as well in college, but I didn't. You need all that laboratory acidy kind of stuff to do etching.
Yeah.
And really, it was not my... I just took it because it was a course. But woodcut became my focus.
It's not crayons or colored pencils or pencils or anything.
No.
You know, it's like, how does an 8 or 9 year old get into doing a linoleum cut?
Oh, well, the art teacher, I went to a private girls' school.
Okay.
And they had a good art teacher who was serious about teaching us kids, even when we were that young, how you do real stuff. We didn't do any kind of art that became popular in schools where you have a kind of gimmicky project, you know, made out of, I don't know, popsicle sticks and Q-tips and that sort of thing. It was nothing like that. It was real.
Yeah.
Real art.
Did you, around that age, or when did you think about your future? I mean, did you think like...
Not at all.
Well, I mean, what were you planning on doing when you went to Smith College?
Actually, I was planning on becoming a doctor.
Okay.
And obviously, I didn't do that. Yeah. But that was more or less just, I was impractical. I didn't have any expectation of having to, for instance, earn a living or having a career. I was interested in medicine. I was interested in dissecting things. That was what I really enjoyed at that era.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually did pre-med at Smith for all the years except for my senior year. And I decided that it would be more fun to follow the folk music trail and go somewhere and have a little subsistence farm, and that's what we did.
And that's what led you to Vermont?
Yep. Well, yes, I knew nothing about Vermont in terms of, well, I was not from New England. It was just, you know, someplace where we had lots of snow. It was bottom line. I want to live somewhere where there's lots of snow. And we couldn't afford Western Mass, and we went to... we went down in the southern mountains because my husband was interested in music. He was a musician, and visited all the mountain people there who had just been discovered by the Smithsonian, and it was very exciting. However, it was a very kind of fundamentalist area, and that we could afford it, but that turned us off too much. So we ended up coming to Vermont because we started heading further north, southern Vermont, middle Vermont, and northern Vermont, where we finally found a little farm that was cheap enough for us to buy.
Before we talk about farming in Vermont, I'd want to...
Oh, we don't have to talk about farming in Vermont. It has nothing to do with illustration.
I'm gonna make it mean something.
All right. Okay.
What was it like studying under Leonard Baskin?
Well,
I mean, you can feel free to say it sucked.
He was a big deal artist.
Right.
And he was there, I believe. He was at Smith for a long time. He was there because they gave him a house and they gave him a salary, and then he could just do whatever he wanted. He seemed to have very little interest in actually teaching.
Uh-huh.
But that was kind of the way art was taught in those days. You know, my painting teacher... would come to class and he would, you know, look at what we were doing and make some sort of non-committal statement or even a positive statement, and then he would disappear. We were just on our own. We were never taught anything about how materials worked. We were just given a list of things to buy for each various art class that we took.
Mm-hmm.
And Leonard Baskin rarely came to class, And when he did, he kind of did the same thing. He just kind of looked around and you know, went kind of humph at whatever he was looking at. But I would have to say, I did take a drawing course from him, and he was completely obsessed with the importance of drawing, and he came to every single class and was he was very, very rigorous. As far as printmaking was concerned, we were just kind of on our own, and he liked the work I was doing then, which was basically based loosely on the kind of work that he did, which I guess is normal enough. But I felt like he gave me a good foundation because he was very critical. He would not put up with anything that was overly sentimental or cliché or anything of the sort.
My guess is that he wouldn't react positively to what you ended up doing many years later, getting into children's books.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's, you know, his opinion.
Actually, he did one children's book that I know of, and I heard this through my agent, who was a friend of Barry Mosher, who's also a well-known printmaker, illustrator. Mm-hmm. And at some point, this book, which is published by a major, like Knopf or something like that,
right.
And his editor said, well, you know, this person is looks completely different and is wearing the wrong thing in some illustration. And he said something like, well, let the little bastards make it up themselves, and refuse to alter anything. So he had a lot of disdain for illustration work.
All right, well, forget him. Anyways, moving on.
Well, no, he gave me such a, by being so critical, he gave me a good foundation in terms of learning really the craft of the work,
right,
as well as whatever subjects I happen to choose to work on.
Right. I had a few teachers like that. I mean, I went to RISD for undergrad and then FIT for graduate school, both with, you know,
yep,
degrees in illustration. And, you know, there are some teachers that I still on occasion will think about. There's one in particular, mm-hmm, my drawing teacher, who I had a few years in a row. And, you know, fabulous artist. And most of the students loved and adored the guy. We just never saw eye to eye on anything. And, you know, and no matter how he was like, you got to draw it this way. This is how you have to hold the pencil. And it wasn't even a pencil. It was one of those holders that you put like charcoal at the end of the holder and then draw it, mm-hmm, sort of like hold it almost as if you're conducting an orchestra.
Really?
And that's how you draw, you know? And I'm like, no. I'm going to hold the pencil the way I want to hold the pencil. This is what's comfortable for me. And it never clicked. Exactly. And I didn't,
sure,
you know, the kids who got A's were the kids who drew just like him. And I just felt everyone's drawings look exactly the same.
Yep.
And it's funny, at the time I thought, man, my drawings are actually pretty good. I mean, I'm good at this figure drawing stuff. And last year, so this was, you know, many 25 years ago, or whatever it was. And last year I was going through some of these drawings, just cleaning out my garage and whatever, and looked at the drawings and they are awful. They're just terrible. So maybe he was right. I don't know.
Oh, that's funny. Yes. Well, I think you probably, you were much younger than I am, and you went at a time when there was more emphasis on how you do things. Whereas when I went, it was just all abstract expressionism. Nobody wanted anything that was realistic at all, and that was it. But mm-hmm, I missed out on a lot of things that I had to learn on my own afterwards.
Yeah. So I know you said you don't want to talk about farming, but I do.
Okay.
Yeah. So you had a farm in northern Vermont. You had horses, oxen, chickens, sheep, and three kids. You said that you always thought...
At various points, yes.
Not at the same time.
At various points we had, not simultaneously. And not really making much money on it, although for a while we had a couple of cows and sold raw milk.
Got it. Who was messier, your three sons or the farm animals?
Oh, I think about equal.
But you said that you always thought of yourself as a factory. you know, raising the kids, you have the farm, you had the maple syrup, but you also did do some work, some artwork on top of all of that.
Oh, yeah. Yes, but I was doing production work. I mean, that's the whole essence of being a printmaker is you make something and then you print it again and again and again until you get rid of the edition, or in some cases I don't have editions. I was just trying to, you know, keep us in food.
Who were you selling to?
Oh, it was the beginning of the era of the craft show, which was a very, very short period of time in retrospect, probably about 25 years, when you could make anything and it was a novelty and people would come and people would buy things. And my first venture into that world was just finding a subject that people were attracted to, quite gimmicky. And I look back in slight horror at the time, but that's what I did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was the object of the moment, the ladybug, the mushroom, the snail, the frog. So we all did little versions in whatever medium we were working in, selling that. And they were they were like throwaways. I didn't consider them anything difficult or serious at the time. Mm-hmm. But it made a living for us.
I mean, was it as clean cut as, like, you know, you're doing well enough with your art and your farm and stuff that you decided, I'm just going to quit teaching? Was there more to it than that?
After I got done teaching in the one-room school, which was grades 1 through 8, which was quite challenging, but mm-hmm. also it's a nice way to learn. And I decided after Jesse was born that I would, they asked me if I would be willing to be a roving art teacher. So I was hired to teach the little town I taught in was Walden, Vermont, nothing to do with Thoreau, but Walden, Vermont, and there were 4 one-room schools, each about 5 miles apart. So one day a week, I would go to the 4 schools. I would spend an hour there, and then I would go on to the next school. It was useless for everybody. So I only did that for 1 year. It was unsatisfactory. The teachers hated it. The kids had to put all their stuff away, and then they had to do some kind of project. It was awful. So after that, I decided, well, maybe I'll become a full-time art teacher in the town that we were living in, which was Cabot. And I can't really remember. I think maybe the superintendent of the school district contacted me. I don't remember ever asking for that job. Anyway, I got hired to do that. And we had moved to Cabot, which was a very conservative, small farming community, right at the time of the height of the Cold War, I guess you could say. And for some reason, our neighbors connected us with Goddard College, which was nearby and which was a hotbed of radicalism. So the rumor circulated that we were communists. And the superintendent of the schools, who hired me to be the art teacher, called up about 2 weeks before school was due to start and said, "I'm sorry, I can't offer you this job. We've had too many calls of complaint from the town." So that was that, and that's when I decided, well, I'll just see if I can make a living just doing art. Since teaching, I wasn't looking forward to teaching art, but it seemed to be the only thing available.
I mean, did you say to him, "Well, that's not true. Unless you are a communist, but I'm not a communist." You know, did you say to him,
"Oh, no, it didn't matter. It was too controversial, and they figured the art teacher is too unimportant to they can find somebody else."
That's not a world I want to live in. It does matter. You know, the truth matters.
Well, of course it does, but I didn't feel passionate about teaching art.
Okay.
In fact, I really didn't want to teach art, but it was something that I could have done. I didn't want to teach art the way it was taught in those days. That is, it was taught in terms of, as I said before, gimmicky projects.
Right.
And that's, in fact, it's still taught that way. And my grandkids go to school here in Calais, and it's still taught that way. So there it was. So that's when I decided to get serious about doing prints and selling prints.
Gotcha. I mean, you're definitely a better person than I am, because I would have walked right over to my neighbor's house and gently knocked on the door, waited patiently until they came out, and then clocked them in the head with my fist. No, I'm kidding. Kind of.
Yes, of course you are. But well, we were on fine terms with our nearest neighbors. But you know, I don't know what they personally thought about us. But they were very. We got along with all of them. Kids played with kids, yeah. All that sort of stuff. But it was a very conservative town. It was the one of two towns in Vermont that voted for Goldwater, that arch conservative, back in the early 1960s. So that was the atmosphere. And Goddard College was nearby, and the students there were totally outrageous in terms of what they did in the town. So I can kind of sympathize a little bit with the town's reaction.
I can't. But again, you're a better person than I am. When did children's books make an appearance? I mean, you said you had an agent. Did it start with an agent? Did it start? I mean, how did that begin?
Oh, no. Oh, heavens, no. It was just happenstance the entire way through. The first illustration job I got was a cookbook. And it was done by a woman in Indiana who was a summer resident of Vermont, and she bought my prints and asked me to illustrate this cookbook. So I did it in, I think, pen and ink and wash drawings, that sort of thing, and was totally thrilled because it actually paid me money, and it wasn't something I had to continue producing. But I didn't think of doing that as a career. But later, there was a program that the Vermont Arts Council instituted called Vermont Images, and they chose two of each discipline, a photographer, musician, a writer, a craftsperson, and fine arts. And I was one of the fine arts persons chosen. And we got a substantial grant of money to spend a year doing a project that reflected something about Vermont. And that's when I decided to do the big series of woodcuts that became the Farmer's Alphabet. And I decided that I would make it a statement about what was obviously a way of life that was viable when we moved there and was fast disappearing. And now, of course, has disappeared almost entirely. So I did this kind of this big woodcuts. They were maybe 2 feet by a foot and a half, and obviously a letter of each alphabet. And when I got them finished, I thought, well, this looks like a book. Why wouldn't this be a book? So I had a friend from Smith who had become a well-known children's book writer. And so I wrote to her and I said, well, what do? And she said, well, get together your portfolio and then make a series of appointments and go to New York. So I did that, and I went to various publishers, and they were, to say the least, underwhelmed. In fact, one of them said to me, nobody does woodcuts anymore. You know, come back with watercolors or something, and we'll consider it. So I packed it all up in my portfolio and went back to Vermont and continued selling prints, which was going pretty well by then anyway. And then maybe a year or two later, I got a call from David Godin in Boston. And he said, my mother, who has a house in southern Vermont, told me that you've done this woodcut alphabet. And I'm not promising anything, but I'd like to see it. Mm-hmm. So I sent in, they had, in the meantime, the state of Vermont had made 1117 reproductions to use in all the classrooms as kind of a classroom aid and classroom decoration. So I just sent them a set of those, and they called back and said, we'll publish it. So it was as simple as that.
And that was roughly 1974?
Yeah, around, well, it was a little later, I think. Farmer's Alphabet was published in 81.
81,
so
okay.
So it would have been maybe the late 70s, 78, 77, 78, something like that. Yeah.
So Mary, don't look now. But we've just connected farming to illustration. See what happened?
Yes, I know.
Okay.
That was 40 years ago.
But still, farming, there is a connection. And that was the connection. You basically these are self-initiated projects. You know, the working on your own prints. Someone saw a print, asked you to illustrate a book. That was the beginning. I mean, these are good lessons to learn for illustrators today. You know, like start create your own stuff. Focus on what
is
around you. Mm-hmm. What is the world doing around you? You know, and, you know, illustrate and write to what you love and what you know. That typically does get people's attention because you typically are more invested in that project and therefore will do better at it and make better decisions and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So, yep. Oh, I agree.
I mean, at that point, I feel like I want to, like, when that book published, did you call any of the New York publishers and say, so what was that about Woodblock Prince? You know, I'm very vindictive.
No,
this morning.
I didn't. And actually, it won some award way back then
okay.
when it first came out.
And you were like,
I forgot what it was. Well, I did kind of think that, but no, I could understand what they were talking about. That was not the way, you know, illustrations were done then, or the mainstream illustrations.
I mean, you've illustrated, what, more than 50 books at this point? Picture books?
Probably, yes. Yeah. Some very small, some letterpress books.
Mm-hmm.
I like working letterpress, you know, where everything is actually printed from the block with handset type.
Do you still have a Vandercook?
I do.
Is it the original one that you first got, or is it new?
No, it's a bigger one. I bought it from my agents. My agents contacted me. It's just another example of how random all of this stuff is and how much dependent it is on circumstance and luck. They called me and said, we would like to come see your work, and we are looking to represent another printmaker. And that was because they had been representing Barry Mosher. And Barry Mosher said, I don't want to do children's books anymore. I'm not going to do it. I want to do projects that are more important to me.
Okay.
So they wanted to have a printmaker that they could represent. So they came to me, and I was totally thrilled because, I don't know, it's exciting. I always liked doing illustration work, and there it was.
Do you remember what year or decade?
Yeah, sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, something like that. Yeah, around there. Probably early 90s.
What's interesting to me is something you wrote to me in our correspondence, setting up this interview, or this chat, rather. You said that you're not an illustrator.
Well, I mean, I'm not
printmaker.
Formally an illustrator. I didn't study illustration.
Well, and neither I didn't did set out. Some most of the greats. They didn't study illustration. They just illustrated.
Well, it's kind of my approach to things. I see things around me. They make me excited, and I make a print that's based on them.
Mm-hmm.
Not fanciful, much more, and not exactly realistic. Sometimes bending the connection between realism and fantasy or, I don't know, emotion, whatever you want to say.
Right.
In fact, now all the work I'm doing is more abstract than it is representational. But I'm not doing it to sell.
So speaking of snow and speaking of randomness and speaking of children's books, in 1999, you won the Caldecott for Snowflake Bentley.
Yes.
Do you remember the phone call?
Oh, yes. I certainly do. I think I did the typical thing that everybody says. You've got to be kidding. You're just joking with me. Turns out they weren't just joking with me.
You know, it's funny. Betsy Lewin had a similar... I asked her the same question. And Betsy Lewin's response was more or less the same. Like, come on.
Yep.
This is a joke, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you're just... You're gonna embarrass me at the end of this call, and I'm going to feel bad. It was that kind of feeling.
So someone said, hey, just want to let you know that you've won the Caldecott medal. And then was there a crowd in the background that shouted? Because that's a thing they do. Or was it just one person?
Kind of, yes. Well, it was one person who called, but then I could hear voices in the background. And then a librarian I know from this area came on the line and said, yes, it's true. We're not kidding.
Take that, Leonard Baskin. How many Caldecotts do you have?
Yeah, right.
The book was, I mean, was that your idea? I mean, Wilson Bentley was a Vermont farmer and a scientist. And this is something that I learned, that no two snowflakes are alike.
Well, I've heard that too, but I don't know if that's really true. But anyway, yes, he was a farmer. He was a farmer, and this was his hobby since he was a little kid. He loved snow, and he loved photography. But he was self-taught, right. Definitely mm-hmm. self-taught, and he just pursued it all of his life. And I think it was completely random. The first book that my agents got me was a book about sheep. And then I think the editor that I worked with at Houghton Mifflin liked that book, so she offered me two books the following year or two, which one was called Barn Cat and one was called Snowflake Bentley. And so I did both of those books the same year. I was still thrilled to be having an actual contract to do a book illustration and being paid what to me was a fairly munificent sum. Mm-hmm. And I put much more time into Barn Cat than I did to Snowflake Bentley, because I was working on that one first. And I thought that was much the better of the two books. And some of the Snowflake Bentley illustrations, I just kind of almost dashed them off quickly. Some I liked. I never don't try my hardest when I'm doing any kind of illustration or any kind of work. But I would have thought that if any book ever won an award, it would be Barn Cat and not Snowflake Bentley. So I was quite...
So you were genuine when you were like, you got to be kidding me, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
So you win the Caldecott, sure. Right? And yep. for folks listening who, you know, maybe they want to win the Caldecott one day, how does that change your career? And I'm assuming it's all positive, but maybe not.
Hmm. We'll have to think about that for a minute or two. Well, I'd say it's all positive, mainly because the next book contract you get pays you a much larger advance.
Yep.
Yep. And also, Houghton Mifflin said, is there any book you want to do? You will do any book you want to do. So that's when I said, yeah, I want to do a gardener's alphabet. So I did the gardener's alphabet. And that was kind of their way of giving me a little reward for having won that prize.
Yeah. This was 99. It wasn't that long ago, but it's been a little bit. Does it still affect your life in any way these days?
Well, I think if I wanted it to, it would. I think if I wanted to do a book, I probably could get the job. But as I said, I'm not interested right now.
Got it. I mean, after you won the Caldecott, were you fielding a lot of requests for interviews and talks and travel and all that kind of thing?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Did you enjoy all of it? Any of it? None of it?
I came to almost enjoy it. It was,
good answer.
You know, the old public speaking thing. Well, what am I going to say? And, you know, oh, my right. God, I've got to get some slides together. I have to, oh, my God. It was kind of horrifying at first, and then for a brief period of time, as I like to say, I became quite pleased with the sound of my own voice. And then after that, it became, I don't want to go, I don't want to travel, I don't want to get in another airplane for a while, I don't want to do this.
Right.
So that was a short period of time, and it was a relief not to have to do that, and of course there's all the book signing stuff that you have to do. I never really enjoyed that.
Right. Is farming still, you're, if I'm doing quick math here, don't ever do quick math on a podcast, you know, above 80.
Yes.
I assume farming is in the rearview mirror. But again, that could be a bad assumption.
Oh, well, farming has been in the rearview mirror since the middle 80s. And when I moved away from the farm we had in Cabot, I split up with my husband. I moved to a school district that had a school that I wanted my kids who were in high school by then to go to. Mm-hmm. And then I eventually bought an old farmhouse here in Calais, Vermont. Calais is spelled like Calais, mm-hmm. but it's pronounced Calais, very definitively here. And so I moved away from the farm in Cabot. And from after that, I've just been a gardener. I haven't had any animals besides the occasional dog or cat.
Gotcha. Do you miss any of it?
And I am still doing that. I am still, we still produce enough food, so we have to buy very little in terms of, well, we don't raise any meat animals, but
right.
I raise practically all the vegetables we eat. My ex-husband has now moved back here, and I gave my old farmhouse to my three kids, and I built a small house right up the road, so we have kind of a compound here.
Excellent. Do you miss farming at all?
No.
Do you miss illustration?
No, I don't. Now I don't have to do anything I don't want to do or do any kind of subject I'm not interested in.
Got it.
And since I have 50 years of blocks, which still can be printed, some of them are limited editions, some are just open editions, so I make enough income off that to be comfortable, and I work on things that I don't ever have to try to exhibit or sell, which is... been very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mostly paintings. I'm doing kind of a combination of print in terms of using black printing ink and painting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm also a little bit of a gardener. When it comes to gardening, I mean, I grew up, again, my father was a farmer. So when he came here in the 60s, my mother came here also. My father via ship and my mother via plane in 66 and 68. Respectively, they're still Italian farmers. So we had gardens at every house,
yes.
Every single house, huge ones, like Olympic sized pool
yep.
gardens, you know.
Yes.
And my favorite thing to do was just like walk up and down the aisles of the garden, kind of like a shopping supermarket or something, eating, pulling peas off the vines, eating the peas, just grabbing a green pepper, and wiping it on my pants and just eating it. I mean, it's so great.
Yeah.
And smelling it. Oh, I love the smell of tomato plants when you're sort of tying the leaves or the stems or whatever to the support, and it just starts smelling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's there's so much to it that's very zen and calming and mental health improving. What do you enjoy?
Oh, yes.
Is there do you have a favorite thing to plant? Is it a flower? Is it a vegetable?
Well, I have a pretty large flower garden, which I'm struggling to maintain.
What's your favorite flower? Do you have one?
No. Peony, foxglove, cannas. I love cannas, but they're a tropical plant. You have to take them in winter.
I love gardenia, but I can't grow them where I live. Darn it.
Yes. Gardenias are tough.
Yep.
Because they get some kind of mealy bugs or little nasty bugs if
yeah.
you bring them in the house. I love them too, but I don't. I've stopped trying to grow exotic plants here.
Right, like every plant I purchase now is native to this area.
Yes,
and it's cool. It's cool to grow, and I've been doing it every now and then. When I have $20 in my pocket, I'll head down to the nursery and. Yeah, what's on sale? What do they have? And it's all just like going up and down the native Pennsylvania plant aisles, and it's really rad. And I planted three
yep.
lilacs around the house, and right now they're mm-hmm. about knee height. But over 20 years from now, they'll be hopefully 6 foot tall, and just the entire house is going to smell like lilac. And I can't wait.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. I have a lot of lilacs here, a lot of native plants.
Mm-hmm.
Garden-wise, probably my favorite crop is the onion crop and garlic. I always plant enough garlic to last us through the year.
I never grew garlic. I don't even know where to begin. Do you just grab like a little bit of garlic and stick it in the ground?
About this time of the year. Plant it this time of the year. You separate the cloves off the stem.
Right.
And stick them in the ground and mulch them and then harvest them the following summer.
And they grow underneath the ground. They sort of expand and grow other
mm-hmm.
cloves.
You put them maybe 3 inches down.
Yeah.
And then they make their tall green leaves in the spring, and then they make that kind of gooseneck scape
yep.
that you cut off. And as soon as they start to turn yellow, maybe in the end of July or early August, you dig them and dry them and save them for the next year and replant.
I mean, I'm not much. I mean, I enjoy it. I wouldn't consider myself to be a gardener with a capital G. For example, last spring, I was digging up some area around the house, and was coming across these little balls. I was like, "What the hell are these things?" And I was trying to dig them up and clean this area out because I was going to plant something in that area. And I kept coming across these little balls, and I was like, well, "I don't who what the hell is this?" And throwing them away. So I saved one and I showed it to my wife Sarah, and I said, "What the hell is this?" And she's like, "That's a bulb. That's a tulip bulb. What are you talking about?" I'm like, "Oh." And so I went back into the woods, found all the balls that I was throwing out, and grabbed them, planted them somewhere else.
and replanted,
And
yeah.
yeah, and they grew, and I was like, "Oh, got it. Got it. They're
Got it.
bulbs."
Yeah.
So I'm still learning. I just want to.
Well, I am too, after how many years growing up on a vegetable farm and having a farm in Cabot and now having this little place, which is really huge. And my daughter-in-law is from Thailand, and she lives down there at my old farmhouse, and she grows some Thai vegetables. She even tried growing rice here, but that didn't work out so well. So, there's Tom, my ex, who's right down, 100 feet from where I am right now, and he has his garden. Dang, has her garden. I have my garden. It's a major enterprise, I would say.
It's the Azarian Garden Corp. Is
Yes,
Azarian
exactly.
Armenian? Is that a safe assumption?
Yes.
You said about cutting wood, and I think this is a great piece of advice for literally any illustrator in any medium, and honestly, any person doing literally anything in life. You can teach yourself, you said. Get yourself some tools, get some good tools, get good
Oh, yes.
wood, and have at it.
Yes.
I love that piece of advice.
Oh, I think it's true, but you do have to have good tools, and you do have to have the right kind of wood. Otherwise, it will be discouraging right from the beginning, just the process. You won't continue with it.
I would say the
The
same thing
same thing
applies
with
to,
paints. Get
yeah, I was
yourself
just going to say.
good brushes,
Yep.
good paints.
Yep.
It's really, really worth it.
Very much. Same goes with digital. Get a good, have a good system, a good
Yep.
chair so you don't hurt yourself, that kind of thing. Same with anything.
Yes, absolutely.
Keeping in mind always that there are illustrators listening in, what would be one, that's a great piece of advice. What would be one more from you to them directly? Take your time.
Gee, I can't think of anything. Make the compositions work with the text, I guess. And be firm in what it is you want to do. Don't let the editors sway you too much. I've worked with editors who were very accepting, and I have worked with editors who wanted to micromanage the whole thing, and that made me hate the project. But, if you stick to your guns, they generally back down.
To learn more about Mary, visit maryazarian.com. If you enjoyed our conversation, please share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, and provide a positive rating and review. Become a patron by visiting patreon.com/illustrationDEPT. In return, you will receive our soft enamel pin, a reusable discount code for 10% off, and access to patron-only episodes we're calling Extra Credit. This podcast is produced by the Illustration Department, a global leader in online education for illustrators. Visit us at illustrationdept.com for class offerings, testimonials, the alumni showcase, the podcast show notes, our forum, the bookshop, and more. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.